Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Who should have access to guns? That question is at the heart of the gun control debate happening here in Florida and across the country. Earlier this week, the Senate Judiciary Committee held a meeting to discuss new federal gun legislation. It would encourage states to implement a system where courts can remove weapons from someone deemed unfit to own them. Florida's red flag laws were enacted as part of the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Public Safety Act following the Parkland massacre. Palm Beach County Sheriff Rick Bradshaw was in Washington, D.C. for those committee meetings, and he joins us now from the studios of WXEL in Boynton Beach. Sheriff Bradshaw, thank you for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me here.
You've reportedly said that if those laws, the red flag laws, had been in place before the shooting, it might have prevented the Parkland massacre. How sure are you of that?
Well, the question was posed by Senator Graham to all four of the panelists. He says, do you think that would have helped prevent it, not absolutely prevented it? And the answer was yes by all of us, but you have to go back and presuppose a lot of things. Presuppose that the people that were at the residence of the perpetrator knew there was guns there, that the mental health people were there. A lot of things would have had to be in place, but it would have given the ability for the people that were there to actually have a process to seize the firearms. Now, you got to understand that the risk protection orders are not something that law enforcement uses just to go out and take everybody's guns. The Second Amendment is quite clear. I'm a big proponent of the Second Amendment, but my statement after that was basically this, and this is not something that I just believe. This is something that's backed up by the individual that was there from the National Institute of Mental Health also. It's not so much the instrument that is the problem. It's whose hands you put the instrument in. It could be a car, a rock, a knife, a pressure cooker, a gun, whatever it is. If you have somebody that's unstable, that has the propensity to commit violence, it doesn't matter what the weapon is, they're going to go use it. So I tried to get them back on track to say this is not a gun control issue as much as it is taking weapons of whatever it is out of the hands of people that have shown the propensity to go commit violence.
And that's the interesting point, is proving that the person is unstable, that could be a threat to themselves or others. It's really, it's almost that question of, well, how do you prove that you can prevent a crime? How do you know that person's going to commit that crime? As a law enforcement officer, do you have a way of saying, I have a good feeling that this is why I know this person is a threat?
No, and that's why I created the unit that I have 5 years ago. And it's important that you understand the composition of this unit, because law enforcement itself, the average deputy on the street, even though they go through basic training, they're not mental health professionals. They can't make that analysis of the individual they're dealing with as well as a trained mental health professional. So when I created this unit, my behavioral services unit, I realized I already had people in place that were deputies that either had a master's or a PhD in psychology or social services, but I needed a mental health professional to be the second part of the team. So I hired local mental health clinicians, professionals, to be part of a team. So the deputy makes up one person, his partner is a mental health professional. So when we have somebody that, or a place that we go to where the person there is exhibiting the behavior that can be analyzed by that team, which is composed of a mental health professional, then they can make that determination, because people's behavior, the way they're acting, and the situation they're in can be analyzed by that mental health professional, and then they can make that determination if that person needs to be Baker-acted, and then they can go in front of the judge and get the arrest protection order.
Let's talk about the mechanics of how this law works. As you said, you just described it's this the behavioral services unit, the team that you put together. But how do we first even know about a person? Is it someone is giving you information, they call in and say, I think this person's a threat? Is it a school system that says, we've been looking at this student? Where specifically are we getting the information about who these people may be? And are we creating a list, by the way, to track people?
No. No, there's no list out there per se. See, if you go back and you read the data, you read the analysis of all of these, quote, mass casualties events or active shooters, the shooter and the people that are involved in this at some point in time had exhibited or expressed the intent to do these things. How many times afterwards where they interview people, they say, well, geez, we know that was going to happen, but they didn't tell anybody. So we're getting better at creating these avenues for information to come to us for law enforcement, whether it's social media. We created an app that we give out to the public and the students where they can anonymously say, look, we know of one of our fellow students, he's got a gun, or he's talking about this, or he's depressed, and he's said that he's going to go do bad things. So we get the information that's based on other people telling us about how they feel about somebody that's in their environment that is exhibiting behavior that threatens them, or they're, I'll give you an example. We had somebody that was on the internet standing there with a firearm in their hands saying, you know, I'm tired of hearing this. I'm tired of being bullied in the school. I'm going to go do X, Y, and Z. So then we go to the location where the person is at and actually confront them and say, why are you doing this? Why are you feeling like this? And that's where the behavioral sciences unit comes in, rather than just have an average deputy go to that scene where they can talk with the person, talk with the family if it's a juvenile, and then get him to a place where he can get the help that he needs. It's not always about an arrest. This is about getting people to a place where they can get the help that they need to resolve the mental issues that they're going through. Now, if in fact there's a firearm there, then the law enforcement side of this, along with the mental health professional, can fill out the necessary paperwork, petition a judge, and then if the judge determines, yes, we believe that the firearms need to be secured, they will issue that risk protection order, and then we can go get the firearm. But there's a legal process to go through.
Right. No, understandably, it's not about you have to go through the judge to be able to say we can take that weapon away. When you do, if you get to that point, what happens to those guns?
All right. The guns will be secured at the agency and put into a place of safety. The person that the firearms are taken from has 14 days to petition the court to say, I don't believe that the firearms should have been taken from me, and then the judge will hear that. If the judge grants that order, it could be as long as a year, and then the people can come back after a year and say, I've been through a process, I'm better, I want my firearms back, and then the judge will determine if, in fact, they can have them back. So all of the due process rights of an individual are there. All of the access to the court system from the individuals are there. But more times than not with these things, and we've done about 16 or 17 of them, the families that we deal with, they're happy that we're going to take these firearms and put them into a safe place until the people get the help that they need.
It's not really an adversarial process
most of the time.
If I may, Sheriff Bradshaw, let me give you a hypothetical. Let's say that my son, son or daughter, is being questioned, and you're concerned that they may be a threat. You know, but they don't own the weapons. I own the weapons. I own weapons in my house, and so am I at risk of you possibly taking away my weapons because they may have access to them?
Well, that depends on how you can convince us that these people are not going to have access to the weapon. I mean, the individual that had the weapon that went down to Parkland, that wasn't his either.
Right. Okay.
Right? So you have to be able to articulate that the subject that is the person in question that should not have access to, that's important, access to, or actually possess the weapons, is not going to get that.
I'm talking with Palm Beach County Sheriff Rick Bradshaw. Bradshaw was recently in Washington, D.C., speaking with lawmakers about Florida's red flag laws. Similar legislation is being proposed on a federal level, again, to encourage states to adopt these kind of laws. Palm Beach County, by the way, has been in the spotlight over other issues I want to touch on here. One of them, of course, human trafficking following last month's arrest of New England Patriots owner Robert Kraft. Sheriff, I wanted to ask you about this issue because Florida is ranked third in the nation in cases of human trafficking. You already know this. And Palm Beach County, third in the state on this issue. This arrest of Mr. Kraft, this was an arrest of a few hundred men. And it was, they had found there was an investigation between the Treasure Coast and Palm Beach County. Do we have a sense of where these human trafficking networks are? I mean, in this case, they found them at these day spas, but do you know where they are, where they're being operated?
Well, the most difficult part of the human trafficking equation is finding out where they're at, because the victims themselves are the people that are being exploited. They have a hard time getting access to law enforcement to actually report it. I don't know all the details of what happened up in the Jupiter case, because we weren't involved in that. That was the Jupiter Police Department. But we've made arrests on, and we have a human trafficking task force. So we rely on tips from the public. And it's not always sex trafficking. It's you know, labor also, forced labor. I mean, it's basically modern-day slavery is what it is. So we rely on other people to call us and say, listen, you know, there's a large group of females that are being housed in an area, and we see a lot of traffic in and out of there. So that's when we go investigate further on, you know, what may be happening in that location. If it's labor, it depends on the people that call us, and they say, you know, there's an awful lot of people that are being picked up at a certain location by a bus, and then they're taken to a place. They work all day. We don't think they're getting paid, da-da-da-da-da-da. So it's hard to get that information because it's such a covert activity. It's just like what you saw happen up in Jupiter there. Some of the females that were involved in actually being the victims fled the area, because they were worried if, in fact, they came forward or got involved in some further testimony, because they might be illegals, that they may be deported. So it's hard for them to come forward, because it's a double-edged sword. They're being taken advantage of, but some of them are illegal and they're afraid to come forward because they might be deported.
Right. And as you said, you have a human trafficking task force. I mean, how much resources do you have to put into this particular issue?
Well, I mean, fortunately for me, I have the manpower to have a decent-sized task force to be able to do it, and it's labor-intensive, and then we have other people from other jurisdictions that are assigned to us, and it's a multi-county Palm Beach, Broward, and Dade task force. So, you know, we have the resources to do it, but it's an ongoing investigation. And it takes time, and you got to get the tips, the right information coming in. And then after that, it's, like I said, a pretty labor-intensive investigation.
I wanted to stay on the issue of human trafficking again, because it's popped up in the news a lot lately, mm-hmm. especially in your area. And I wanted to move over to the big story of the Palm Beach millionaire Jeffrey Epstein. And last month, U.S. District Judge Ken Mara determined that federal prosecutors broke the law in concealing the plea deal. But I'm asking you, as a man of the law, as a law enforcement agent, your take on the report that Epstein didn't get federal prison time, he went to jail, and then he was allowed, when he was in West Palm Beach, to have work release and leave the prison or the jail cell for 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, according to records. Is that normal for someone who's sentenced to jail to have that kind of work release?
Well, you got to understand the difference between a jail and a prison. Jail is temporary, and it's most time for very, very not heinous crimes, what we're talking about. The Epstein case, all we did was house him. We didn't investigate it. We weren't involved with the state attorney's office. Our job was just to house him. He met the criteria for work release, as is anybody else in there. He wasn't adjudicated a violent sex offender. He wasn't even adjudicated a sex offender. He had a prostitution case against him. So he qualified for what work release would be for any other person similar situated. So there was no reason to deny him. It had nothing to do with who he is, what his money was, or anything else. He fell under the guidelines, and he got the work release, because, just that simple.
Because the policy is, if you are a sex offender, a convicted sex offender, you cannot get work release.
Yep, but that's not what he did. He was in there for prostitution. That was the plea.
I mean, all of this is now coming back, and there are people in Congress who are talking about trying to look back into this case, and they are looking at the prosecutors, the prosecution team, but is there any concern that they want to come back and look and say everybody in any way, and I know you were just housing him, but to look and say, okay, we got to reopen this case?
Well, that's up to them to reopen the investigative part and the prosecution part and what the prosecution decided to do. That's up to them. I went by the guidelines. I am not concerned at all about whether it was done properly or not, because it was, and we'll go from there. But it's just like what you're looking at right now in the Smollett case up there.
Yes.
Same thing. So they're going to go back and look at that. But I don't control the state attorney's office. I don't control the federal prosecutors. I don't control the investigators. They come to us. I house them. I go by the rules, and that's it.
As a lawman again, though, do you have any issue with how all this case went down? Or do you even think about that?
I'd have to go back and do months of research from the very beginning of the case. So I don't know the answer to that question. The only thing I can answer you is when people come to us, they're incarcerated for a year or less, because that's what a jail is. It's not a prison. Then I go by the guidelines that they're in there for. That's all I can do.
Thank you, by the way, for clarifying that. Again, the difference between jail and prison. We've been talking with Palm Beach County Sheriff Rick Bradshaw. Again, he joined us from the studios of WXAL in Boynton Beach. As we mentioned, he was up in Congress recently for a Senate committee hearing. Senate right now looking at federal gun legislation. Florida does have these laws in place right now, the red flag laws that were put in place after the Parkland shooting. And Congress right now looking to see if they want to encourage other states, all states, to follow our example. By the way, Florida, not the only state that has such laws. Sheriff Bradshaw, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for your time today.
Okay, thank you for having me.
All right, still to come, we're going to meet the Grand Marshal for the upcoming Miami Beach Pride. That's coming up next here on Sundial.